This is Jim Ketterer here at WAMC with Ambassador Robert Gassende, talking to him about his amazing life and career working around the world as part of the U.S. Foreign Service, working on public diplomacy and some of the places that intersected with some of the most important events in the second half of the 20th century. Bob, when we finished the last episode, we were talking about your time in Poland. And as you left Poland, you came back to the U.S. and you spent a year at a small, unknown college in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What was that place and what was that experience?
Well, Mary Beth and I spent 4 years in Warsaw. That was a year more than the normal three-year assignment. Now, remember, at this point, we've never served in Washington. We've managed to avoid service in the headquarters of our agency.
The ultimate hardship post.
I could no longer avoid that. I was going to be assigned to Washington. But on the way to Washington, I spent a year at the Harvard Center for International Affairs, an organization set up by Henry Kissinger when he was teaching at Harvard.
Who were some of the luminaries who were associated with that center at that time?
Well, I guess the most outstanding name probably is Sam Huntington, who was writing his famous book, Clash of Civilizations. As a fellow at Harvard, Mary Beth and I had a wonderful opportunity. I mentioned Mary Beth because she was offered the same opportunity. We were given the opportunity to audit any class we wanted in the curriculum of the whole university, which is a wonderful opportunity to sit on some of the most intelligent people around the world. And so Mary Beth did a lot of work in nutrition at Harvard and at Tufts. Tufts and Harvard were in a partnership for a good deal of this time, running the Center for International Affairs. That segued into our assignment to Washington for the first time. I was assigned first in the Speaker's Bureau, which probably deserves a few words at some point, and then later in the Central Office of the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs.
What does the Speaker's Bureau do as part of our diplomatic effort?
Speaker's Bureau, believe it or not, reviews and works to fulfill a speaker's list for posts, USIA posts abroad. In other words, the posts come back and say, we need someone to come and talk to us about X. And sometimes they will have a name request for somebody that they would like to have. Sometimes they just ask us to recruit somebody who can come out and speak to this issue. This is something, I think, uncommon in normal diplomacy, but it works.
An embassy will say, well, we need somebody to come out and talk about, some specific economic issue or cultural issue or maybe a public health issue. And the Speaker's Bureau has this pool of people who are kind of pre-approved to be on that list and be drawn to make those trips.
Exactly.
Although I'm sure that you had some times where, in theory, speaker X or Y is great, but when you get them out in the field, things might go a little differently than you had planned.
Yeah, that's always a great surprise.
Yeah, that's right. Surprises are usually good surprises.
Sometimes, I must say, it's rare for that to happen, for somebody to bomb overseas. Generally, if they're good at home, they're good overseas as well.
And then you were in the Education and Cultural Bureau.
Yes. That Speaker's Bureau was part of the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Information Agency and then the Department of State. That is the bureau that handles all of the academic and cultural exchange activities the U.S. conducts abroad, like the Fulbright Program, for example.
Also during your time in Washington, you were the principal deputy assistant secretary for the Africa Bureau.
Yes. I was the director of the Office of African Affairs in the U.S. Information Agency. And that's the equivalent of principal deputy assistant secretary of state for Africa.
And this was, I think, was this during the early years of the Reagan administration?
It was.
And
one of the interesting twists is we would always inform in the Speaker's Bureau, for example. It's just a side anecdote here. We would always inform the front office that we were going to recruit a speaker to go overseas. Better to have your boss not blindsided by something he doesn't know about. On the rare occasion, the front office would come back and say, no, we don't want to send that guy. That list, we then decided we should keep a list of who they didn't want to send, because there's no sense beleaguering somebody, putting their name forward, you know, two or three times. That list became the refusal list. That was revealed to be, you know, the list where the Reagan administration censored certain people from serving overseas, from lecturing overseas.
So when you were in Washington, you were far more apt to run headlong into partisan politics as opposed to being overseas and working in an embassy.
Absolutely. Especially in the Reagan administration. Reagan administration became extremely involved in, were sensitive about what was going on in the belief that they could control or be creative with who we did.
And as I recall, they had a very active Assistant Secretary of State for Africa.
Yeah, Chet Crocker became Assistant Secretary for Africa, invented the famous phrase constructive engagement.
Constructive engagement or policy toward South Africa.
Over policy, yes. Toward South Africa. I was arguing for engagement of any kind, constructive or otherwise, because constructive engagement actually, I got a cable once in Pretoria asking me to list the number of black people who had appeared at the ambassador's dinner table in the first 2 years of his administration during the Reagan administration. I got on the telephone and I said, you need to suck that request out of the atmosphere. You don't want me to answer it, because if I answer it, it's going to be leaked immediately. The number was 3. So constructive engagement certainly was not aimed at black folks.
So you mentioned South Africa. So when you left the Africa Bureau in Washington, you went back to South Africa. You had been there already, and you returned to South Africa in the early to mid-1980s. Some of the most very difficult times of apartheid.
Yes. We were in South Africa the first time from 1970 to 1973. The second time from 1983 to 1987. And then the third time, I was back there for a year in the run-up to the election of Nelson Mandela in 1993-94.
So in your time there during the 80s, you were there as the public affairs officer.
I was.
So that's the highest ranking public diplomacy officer in any of our U.S. embassies. This is a key position in the embassy. It's certainly a key position in presenting and articulating American policy to the local population. This is happening at the same time that American college campuses are in absolute protest over the policy of a constructive engagement, and they are seeking divestment of American funds from anything that supports the South African apartheid regime. So you're having to manage the messages from home as well as the policy from Washington.
It was a difficult dance. People were calling for divestment, for disengagement. If you believe in diplomacy, you don't believe in disengagement. Engagement is, you know, you can't have much impact on a country using a megaphone on the deck of a destroyer 12 miles off the coastline from the country you're trying to have influence over. You have to be there.
Yeah.
And so there's a difficult dance you have to go through.
Right. I mean, there are countries right now that we don't have diplomatic relations with, meaning we don't have an embassy there. And in many ways, you end up flying blind. You don't negotiate with your friends as much as you negotiate with your adversaries. And so you saying, you know, this type of engagement was needed But it was an interesting moment in American politics as well for the campuses to be in an absolute uproar over this.
It was. The year that I spent at Harvard, we got to the Harvard president. By we, I mean me and a very famous South African journalist named Donald Woods, who had been editor of the East London Daily Dispatch in East London, South Africa. Donald was at Harvard the same year that I was there, and we got to Derek Bach and said, we shouldn't be disengaging. The kids are screaming for this to happen, but you need to know why it shouldn't happen. And very quietly, Derek Bach joined the dance around that, and we didn't completely disengage.
When you were on the ground in South Africa and you're interacting with some of the key anti-apartheid elements of the opposition, what were their views of what was going on in the United States?
Well, first of all, black South Africans had, this is something we worked very hard to overcome at the U.S. Information Service in South Africa, is providing information so that people could get accurate information. South African newspapers were either self-edited, self-censored, or had their own parochial points of view as far as what U.S. policies should look like. But we tried to overcome that.
Well, we will segue to another chapter in your career and in American foreign policy in Africa when we meet next and talk about your second time in Somalia.
Okay.
I'm Jim Ketterer, speaking with Ambassador Robert R. Gassende about his career in the diplomatic corps in a special 6-part series for the Roundtable on WAMC. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the U.S. Foreign Service.